You are listening to a sermon by Kevin Miller, recorded on Sunday, April 14th, 2013, at the Point Grey Interminonite Fellowship in Vancouver, British Columbia. The opinions expressed by the speaker are not necessarily those of the church. This recording is licensed for personal use by individuals only and may not be copied, broadcast, or redistributed without the prior permission of the church board. For more information, please visit our website at www.pgimf.org.
It's great to be here. You guys nailed the day for your barbecue. Sun shining through the stained glass window here. Well, it's doubly nice to be here just because I actually came to faith within an MB church, a small MB church, which was actually a combination of MBs and GCs in Saskatchewan. So it's kind of feel at home, especially singing out of the hymn book here this morning. So, as many of you know, I worked on this film, Hellbound, and in case you don't know much about the film, Hellbound is a movie it's a feature-length documentary that seeks to provoke some informed discussion around the issue of hell. So we look at three main families of views, one being what people would call the traditional view, the idea of hell as a place of eternal torment. And then two other minority positions, one being annihilationism, which is the idea that torment doesn't last forever, it comes to an end, and the other being universalism, which is the idea that the punishment that the wicked would receive, if you want to use that sort of terminology, is ultimately redemptive, and so that it will lead ultimately to reconciliation. So these are the different family of views, and we explore this theological discussion in the film, as well as some of the real-world implications of really where we come out on this. So this is my first time, actually. I've worked on a number of films, but it was my first time as a director, producer, so really helming the project, so it was really a unique experience. So something else that we did is that we also controlled the marketing and release of the film. So that's something that we kind of kept in-house, and we hired people to help us with that. And what that allowed me to do was to do something that I don't know if too many filmmakers do this, but I'd highly recommend it, is I was able to tour with the film all across North America. I took about 2 months, and I did Q&A screenings at I don't know how many cities, a couple dozen or more cities all across the U.S. and Canada. So we'd show the film, and then somebody local would facilitate a discussion afterwards. And it was really a fascinating opportunity to really see how the film is impacting people from all different walks of life. And I have to say that something, we just did a screening the other night in Port Moody, and this is the first question I got asked, and this is almost the first question I get asked by every reporter. Reporters kind of drive me crazy. It shows that they just don't do any research, because they ask me the same like first five questions that every single other reporter has asked me. So it's like, do some research, reporters, if there's any journalists in the room. But the question that I get asked most commonly is, goes something like this: why did you make this movie? What motivated you to make this film? And sometimes behind that question, I hear another question, which goes a little more like this. It says, why on earth did you make this movie? What possessed you to make this movie? Why the hell did you make this movie? Or as my mom used to say it, why would such a smart boy do something so stupid? Well, I've probably answered this question a dozen different ways over the last several months. And I can say on the surface, for me, the real tipping point to make a movie about hell was me editing a book on hell for a guy named Brad Jersak back in the fall of 2008. And that really was something that just really brought this conversation into my conscious awareness. Prior to that, I'd worked with Brad on a number of other projects, one of which was really revisiting different views of the atonement. So really, what was really going on there when Jesus was crucified and the resurrection. And so looking at ideas where the violence that's happening isn't something that's being attributed to God, it's something that's being attributed to human beings, and God is really trying to redeem us out of that. Another reason for making the film is that I call myself always the bridesmaid, never the bride, in terms of that I've spent most of my career as a writer. Before I got into film, I was a writer and editor. I was always helping other people achieve their vision. I was always facilitating that, and I had all these sort of things churning inside of me. So in January 2011, when I embarked on this project, I was going to turn 40 in a couple months, and I thought, if I'm not going to get into the driver's seat now, you know, when am I going to do it? So this is a bit of my midlife crisis as well. And I think, though, on a deeper level, I think really what led to me making this film goes back to this photo. Do you have that photo handy, Kevin?
Yeah.
Look at that good-looking young guy. His pants hiked up. But this is me, the summer this is probably a day after, maybe 2 days after I became a Christian at a Bible camp. And that's the award I'm holding is Best Boy Camper. So you have the Best Boy Camper 1980 standing in your midst. There was something interesting that happened that summer. I was 9 years old, and I had never really heard the gospel before, the way it was presented to me at that camp. And I grew up on a farm, and I remember coming out and to help my family work in the garden one evening. I remember standing there on the driveway, and I just had this sinking feeling in the pit of my stomach when I realized that if my family didn't come to know what I just learned, they were all going to go to hell. And I was terrified. I mean, I felt sick to my stomach. I don't remember what happened after that, but I do know that I kind of pleaded in my quiet time for God to somehow save them. And so I think that when we look at something like Hellbound, how does it come to be? I think it begins with these very early experiences that become really they define the rest of your life. But so I can articulate these different reasons of why I made the film, but I'm not sure if any of these reasons really tell the whole story, because think about anything you do. Why do you do anything? I mean, really, we can all tell a good tale. After the fact, we can always rationalize after the fact, but in the heat of the moment, what's really motivating us? So I want to kind of look a bit more into that this morning. A writer I've always enjoyed and admired is George Orwell. If you don't know him, he wrote the books Animal Farm and one of my favorite novels of all time, 1984. He was a brilliant writer, and I think his work is admired as much for its literary merits as for some of the subversive ideas he managed to tuck in there. And he wrote an essay, a short essay called Why I Write. I'm not sure if somebody asked, he probably was trying to respond to repeated questions about that. Sort of what possessed you to write this book, George? And he came up with four reasons, and I thought they were really interesting reasons. The first one, he was pretty honest about it. He said, egoism, the desire to seem clever. He wanted to be talked about at parties. I think that's pretty honest of him to admit that. To be remembered after death, to get back at those who snubbed you. Serious writers, I should say, are on the whole more vain and self-centered than journalists, though less interested in money. That's a quote from George. And I would say I could probably identify with that, except the money part. I'm pretty interested in money. Especially when I don't have much of it. My interest grows. So, first reason, egoism. Second one, aesthetic enthusiasm. The perception of beauty in the external world and the desire to reflect this in some way. I think every artistic person or, even with a ghost of artistic interest can identify with this. I think for me as a writer, the thing that first made me become aware that maybe I might have a gift for this was a poem I wrote for Remembrance Day in grade 5. I wish I had a copy of it, but I remember there was a phrase that I put together and I remember sitting back and looking at it and just it was the way it sounded and I went, wow, that's good. That's interesting. And so you just discover this joy of just putting different words together. Today with film, one of my favorite things to do is edit, because then you get all this footage that you've shot, and it's so fascinating. Once you start to put it on a timeline, which is how a movie gets made, is you have this timeline, you bring different pieces of footage in. It's the happy accident that happens in the editing room. I always love it. I did that the other day. I was working on something to do with serial killers, and I put a whole bunch of photos of serial killers in a timeline just thinking I was going to do something with them, and then I just pressed play because I was trying to look at a transition, and suddenly it just rifled through all these faces, and the effect of it with the music and all that sort of stuff was like something I hadn't anticipated, and suddenly it became the focal point of the whole piece that I was editing. So it's just this. So aesthetic enthusiasm is another reason to write or to create art. My daughter's getting a little wave there. So the sheer joy of life. A third reason he gave was historical impulse. It's kind of an odd phrase, but he put it this way, is a desire to see things as they really are, or at least to get a step closer to the universe as it is. This is interesting. I mean, I'm not sure your folks' background, but I know Richard Rorty and certain philosophers would kind of think that's kind of an unusual thing to say. But I mean, I've often said that, you know, what people are striving for is the closest approximation of reality. But that, of course, assumes that there is a reality. There's an objective core to reality that we can actually finally see without filters. And of course, there's the jury's definitely out on that. But the point is I think that what he's really trying to say, what George Orwell is saying, is that there's constructive ways of seeing the world, and there's less constructive ways of seeing the world. And I think what often motivates an artist is hitting upon a fresh perspective that maybe will help us move past a situation that we're in. And I think that the fourth reason that he gave kind of relates to this one is a political purpose. And he would use the term political here in the broadest sense of the word. And here is another quote from George saying, he says, what motivates him often is a desire to push the world in a certain direction, to alter other people's idea of the kind of society that they should strive to create. Once again, no work of art is generally free from political bias. The opinion that art should have nothing to do with politics is itself a political attitude. So, four reasons to create: egoism, aesthetic enthusiasm, historical impulse, and a political purpose. And as you can imagine, these impulses are often at war within the life of the artist. So, and I think that the relative importance of these things is going to change from person to person. And at different points in a person's career, you're going to see, I think every artist kind of goes this path where we're just sort of excited we can actually do this thing, play the guitar, run a film camera, and so we're just really... you know, pretty much egocentric in how we're doing things, but eventually we begin to see the power of image and the power that it has to communicate and transcend all sorts of barriers. So if I look at these four reasons and go back to answer that question, why did I make Hellbound? If we discount the first reason, egoism, which is a given, I mean, every artist really, I think that there's a certain moment where you think, I have something important to say. And, you know, the whole world needs to hear what I'm thinking. If that thought doesn't hit you at a certain point, you just will never create anything. So I don't know how you get away from that. But if I look at these other reasons, I have to say that I think on a gut level, my strongest motive to make the film would fit into the category of political purpose, that it was really a desire to push the world, to push the church, and to push myself in a certain direction, to alter our idea about the kind of world, the kind of community, the kind of church, the kind of life that we're striving to create. So, how could a documentary like Hellbound possibly do such a thing? Well, the tactic I took was to challenge people, and again, I'll put myself as the first person, to really challenge us to reconsider what lies at the very foundation of our belief of what constitutes the good. And that is our image of God. So can we go to that film clip? Actually, let's go to the other one I sent you. Yeah, here's a clip from the film that hits upon this issue.
You know, every doctrine of hell presupposes a view about God. So every doctrine of hell has a theology behind it. So whenever you come across a particular view of hell, the question you ask yourself is, well, what does this view of hell tell us about God? I mean, what kind of God is it that does this?
And I think what we're trying to say is that fundamental to your question about hell and all these other things is, who is this God?
Right.
Right? Because if you get that wrong, everything's wrong. And so I constantly go back and ask, do I have a God who's actually less of a father than I am?
Okay. Well, thank you. Short clip. But... this is something that Rob Bell in his book Love Wins, he called it the question behind the question. So if you have questions about hell, ultimately what you're having questions about is God. So who is God? A.W. Tozer, probably familiar with that name, you might know this quote. He says, what comes into our minds when we think about God is perhaps the most important thing about us. I think that's a great summary, because I come from things from the perspective of, you know, René Girard, mimetic theory, and where imitation is the core of human existence, that we that imitation is really the highest good of humans, but it also leads to the worst actions of human beings. But we don't just imitate each other, we imitate the God that we believe in. We all become agents of that God on earth, because why else would we attach ourselves to that God if we didn't see ourselves as on earth fulfilling the agenda of that God? So the question of who is God is ultimately important. So thinking along those lines, Hellbound opens with a scripture passage at the beginning on a black screen. And I was partly inspired to do that by one of my favorite films of all time called Platoon, which is a story set in the Vietnam War back before Charlie Sheen kind of went that way, when he was a great young actor. And the movie begins with a quote from Ecclesiastes 11:9 that says, "Rejoice, O young man, in your youth." And then the next thing we see is Charlie Sheen getting off an airplane, and it's being loaded onto the plane he just got off of is a bunch of body bags. So it's a very ironic opening. I thought it was a beautiful use of that passage. So, of course, I want to try and go head-to-head with Oliver Stone. So I'm looking for something that just really is going to be the perfect, focusing statement at the beginning of Hellbound. So there's a few different candidates, one of which doesn't come from the Bible. It's a little bit too sarcastic, which is why we rejected it. It comes from Voltaire. It says, "If God has made us in his image, we have returned the favor." then there's another one that comes from the scripture passage today we read, which says, "Why do you break the command of God for the sake of your tradition?" Or, "Why do you nullify the command of God for the sake of your tradition?" Again, it felt a little negative. And we ended up going with a different passage. "Will not the judge of all the earth do what is right?" Which is Genesis 18:25. And we settled on that because this is a statement about God rather than a statement about human beings. It's not so much a statement about a characteristic of God. It's really articulating an assumption about God, a hope that that if we relinquish control of ourselves, if we abandon ourselves to the universe, it's a safe decision to make. Without this kind of hope or trust in God, I think that there's only one default position, which is fear. Because if I can't trust God, who can I trust? Me. You know that statement from Robert Owen, who said, the whole world is a bit strange except thee and me, and I'm not so sure about thee. And the problem is, the moment we become fearful, the first thing we reach for is control. Because we've got to find a way to protect ourselves from the thing that we fear the most. Now, it might differ for different people, but shame, ridicule, poverty, loneliness, death, these are the things that we're always worried are coming down the pike. And so the moment we kind of abandon that trust in God, in the goodness of God, and we fall back on ourselves, we fall into a position of fear, and so we develop a control system. And that control system will now put us at odds with everyone around us, because we either have to get people to submit to our system, or we have to sort of get rid of them, because otherwise they're going to forever be a threat to us. René Girard, who I mentioned earlier, would say this is the primary function of religion, especially pre-Christian forms of religion, which is it's really a violence control mechanism. It's a way of protecting ourselves against runaway violence. Ernest Becker, who's another thinker I admire, he wrote a book called The Denial of Death. He talks about something, an immortality project or an immortality system. This is something that we develop as a way of sort of transcending these fears about death. It's a substitute for life in Christ, I would say, or trusting God. And so I would say that this whole situation of a fear-based control system is exactly what Jesus is encountering in the passage that we read this morning, where he's being confronted about his disciples breaking the law, and he turns it back on them and says that your laws are the problem, not my disciples' behavior. And so he says, these people honor me with, he says, Isaiah was right about you. These people honor me with their lips, but their hearts are far from me. They worship me in vain. Their teachings are merely human rules. And then he goes off and reads a litany of woes against these poor Pharisees and teachers of the law. I'll read a brief segment. Woe to you, teachers of the law and Pharisees, you hypocrites! You shut the door of the kingdom of people in heaven's, or kingdom of heaven in people's faces. You yourselves do not enter, nor will you let those enter who are trying to. Woe to you, teachers of the law and Pharisees, you hypocrites! You travel over land and sea to win a single convert, and when you have succeeded, you make them twice as much a child of hell as you are. And that's just the beginning. He's just getting warmed up. So I would come back and say, you know, some of the same questions that were asked me with Hellbound is what would motivate the Pharisees to create such a system? Why on earth would they do such a thing? What would possess them to do it? Why would so many smart guys do something so stupid? And I think because we have to go back to this idea of the image of God that they have in their heads, and they believe that they are serving this God. They are protecting this God. Barbara Brown Taylor, I think, says you'll never see people so do things so ugly as when they believe that they're protecting God. They no longer trust God. They have now taken it upon themselves that they're the ones, not only God's agents on earth, but God's protectors. And they become very destructive. As I said, there's a system that you must either conform to or be eliminated by. And Jesus falls into the latter category. So where did this image of God come from in the Pharisees and the teachers of the law? I mean, that's a scholarly discussion that can be had, but you know, we really have four sources of beliefs. One would be scripture, the other would be tradition, reason, and experience. And these things work together in our heads. And I think a lot of us are maybe like the Pharisees, is that we think our image of God comes from the scriptures. But as much as evangelicals like to cling to something like sola scriptura, none of us ever read the Bible as it is. We read the Bible the way we are. So there's always a tradition that's acting as an authority. There's always some kind of a guide that's between us and the text, causing us to see it in a certain way. My friend Ron Dart, who appears in Hellbound, says, every reading of the text reveals some things and conceals others. I think that's a great insight. It's always frustrating because he always brings that up to me when I get excited about an idea. And he's like, okay, now, what are you missing? It's like, can I just be excited for a moment? but the problem is that we fall so in love with what our tradition reveals that we forget to consider what it might conceal. And so we mistake part of the truth for the whole truth. And this leads us into all sorts of false dichotomies and pointless conflicts. I teach screenwriting. This is pretty much the story of every film, is that two characters, we call them the good guy and the bad guy, the protagonist and the antagonist, but really what's happened is two people have latched onto part of the truth, which they're absolutely unwilling to surrender, which they shouldn't have to surrender. But the problem is each one of them has mistaken it for the whole truth. And so, you know, ideally what you want to see in a film is two people, not just one dominate the other, but the two come and form a synthesis. But this is very difficult for us to see in the midst of our conflicts, because again, we all think we're out there protecting God, doing the things that need to be done. So going back to the quotes that were candidates to be at the front of Hellbound, I think Voltaire was right, that in a sense we all create God in our image. We're all like the Pharisees on one level or another. And I think it's inevitable. Every generation sees things differently because of the context that they're in. But the question is, and so I think it's, I don't think we need to beat ourselves up for the idea that we're always projecting things onto God. I think the question we need to be asking ourselves is, what kind of image is our image of God creating in us? And how is that image being reflected to the world at large? This is one of the central questions that we look at in Hellbound. So Voltaire, I think, was right. But I think Jesus was right too, believe it or not. That we all nullify the command of God for the sake of our tradition at times. We're all at least susceptible to doing that sort of thing. And so I think it's always worth examining ourselves. Because if we go back to George Orwell, I think what that always represents is retreat into egoism. is a retreat into fear-based control systems. And I think the only way to transcend egoism is to go with the quote that we did go with in the film, is to really say, surely the judge of all the world will do what's right, and cast ourselves onto the love and mercy of God. Because then, I think only then will our lives and our art, or whatever we create, achieve the highest goals that Orwell talked about, which would be beauty, truth, and peace. I'm going to read another quote from Orwell. Sorry, I totally have not looked at my watch. Hopefully I'm still in the time frame here. But Orwell says, all writers are vain, selfish, and lazy. And at the very bottom of their motives, there lies a mystery. Writing a book is a horrible, exhausting struggle, like a long bout of some painful illness. I can totally identify. One would never undertake such a thing if one were not driven on by some demon, whom one can neither resist nor understand. For all one knows, that demon is simply the same instinct that makes a baby squall for attention. And yet it is also true that one can write nothing readable unless one constantly struggles to efface one's own personality. Good prose is like a window pane. I can't say with certainty which of my motives are the strongest, but I know which of them deserve to be followed. And looking back through my work, I see that it's invariably where I lacked a political purpose that I wrote lifeless books and was betrayed into purple passages, sentences without meaning, decorative adjectives, and humbug generally. So, thank you very much.